Welcome to the latest in my series of nostalgia interviews. My name is Chris DC and Linda Pike is my guest this week. Linda works at BTHQ in London as a project manager and graduated from Lampeter in French in 1995. Now, Linda reveals why Lampeter was like a pleasure dome, how it wasn't a judgmental place, how she embraced the away-from-home experience. We talk about the melting pot of people in Lampeter, how she would get paid to socialise by working down the bar. And then there's a bit of a revelation when Linda talks about how she had access to the reject button on the jukebox down the Union Bar and when and how she would use it. And Linda likens Lampeter to Neapolitan ice cream. Linda was born in Essex. She grew up in South Devon. We learn that her earliest memories involve a cuddly lion called Leo. We discover that Linda is a kinesthetic person. She talks about how she would go swimming on Sundays when she was young and that today her happiest state involves being at the seaside. When she was young, she would record programmes off the radio. We find out that the first album she was given was Seven and the Ragged Tiger by Duran Duran. We find out why Linda prefers not to order cards through Moonpig and why the wrong lyrics in a song are often better than the original. Chicken tikka and all that. Linda was once the second youngest licensee in the country. We find out how she moved into business development and then into her present job at BT. We learn about how Linda is very people-focused within a technical environment and why the analogy of a conductor is appropriate. Linda reveals that she is passionate about scuba diving and how it is a counterpoint to work and the tendency that we have to live life through screens. She talks about being very collaborative and inclusive and about how people are multifaceted rather than one-dimensional. And she talks about the things that we learn about people outside of, say, their work environment. Then towards the end, the conversation moves on to our love of film and how one can be transported somewhere and even have a kind of out-of-body experience. The first film that she and her husband went to was a Muppets film, and Linda talks about her favourite films, including Jaws and Pulp Fiction, which came out during her final year at university. Then at the very end, we learn why Linda is a glasses-half-full person. We find out what she would do if she could have her time again, and that includes doing a degree in marine biology. And at the very end, Linda reveals whether she is a looking back or a looking forward type of person. So what an absolute pleasure to catch up with Linda before the lockdown in February 2020 for the latest in my series of nostalgia interviews. My name is Chris DC. Well, it is such a pleasure to have Linda Pike for... Now, we were just talking before we started recording. It must be at least 25 years since we last saw each other, because we were both students at Lampeter.
Yes, I think it was. I left in... Let me see, I arrived in 91, and I graduated in summer of 95. So, yeah, 25 years.
Yeah, with a year abroad in France.
Yes.
Yeah.
Gosh, that's a long time ago.
And well, exactly. And in my case, because I stayed in Lampeter for... 10 years. There were kind of like other generations of students who came and went in that time, so I think it made it harder for me ever to go back, because there's just so much to unpack from a very concentrated period. And you know, a student generation is 3 years, so, or 4 years in your case. But Lampeter must hold some really good memories.
Oh, it does, yeah, in the main, I'd say. Definitely. It's one of those places where at the time, I don't think you maybe realise how special it is or how kooky it is. Since, you know, looking back on it now, I have lots of other friends I've met since my time at Lampeter who went to larger universities, and they don't seem to have had quite the same experiences or quite the same nature of friendships that I think we had. I think Lampeter was, to my mind, a bit like a pleasure dome, a little bit of a bubble. And I think that's either something that's very attractive or very abhorrent, depending on which side of the fence you sit on. To me, it was really attractive because I think all sorts of people went there. It didn't seem to be too much of a judgmental place. I think there was a bit of a... I think anybody could have fitted in there, basically. And I think it was a very friendly place. I think back to the types of people I met and some of whom I'm still in touch with, and there's such a broad range of types of people that I don't think I would have had that had I gone to Liverpool or a large university and just sort of stuck to the people I met in my tutor group.
Yeah, because I feel that Lampeter is the kind of place that, because it is so small, it really means that people can grow. That, you know, you'd be perhaps dwarfed in a larger university, but here, you know, there were lots of very big, very eccentric people, myself included, in a very small town. I think that juxtaposition may not have worked for everyone, but for those who, and once you've made the trek all that way west, you kind of never wanted to leave. It was more like, well, I've been through this.
I'm here now.
Yeah.
I've driven all that way.
Yeah. Like, well, I'm not going to go all the way back again. I'm going to stay here for at least 10 weeks and then, you know.
Yes.
But then we'll determine what to do during
the vacation. I think from a parental point of view, it's probably quite nice because I've got friends now at our age who have their children, even though they're not kids anymore, at university. They seem to be going home every other weekend to get their washing done and stuff, and we didn't have that luxury, which I think in a way is a good thing, because you completely embrace the being away from home experience, and you had to learn where the laundrette was underneath Burgess.
It was, yeah. And there was another one, but in OB,
and
I went back in the sub, and it's still there. It's like probably the same machine.
Do you remember in Burgess, underneath Burgess, there was the washers, there were those massive tumble dryers. I used to be young enough, agile enough and slim enough that I could get in those tumble dryers, and our party trick was to get in there, make it go around a couple of times and then get out.
Yeah, I was going to say, as long as the person on the other side closes the door and says, hey,
there was a lot of trust involved.
Yeah, I was going to say, that would have been, was that after the 1 o'clock Friday night?
After the ubiquitous bar promo.
But the thing that I remember though from that period is, students tended to stay, but officially, this is the thing that's so funny considering where I work now, where students don't stay on campus.
Right.
And a lot of them work off campus, have families off campus, they will come in. Effectively, they commute. Not in all cases.
Yeah.
But back then in Lampeter, officially, if you wanted to go home for the weekend or whatever, you had to go to the Porter's Lodge and you were supposed to sign out. And I remember once doing that and I thought, you know, that's ridiculous.
Yeah.
But that's what I mean. And that's how different things were from the early 90s to now, where it is quite normal for students to live off campus, but also it means that there can be great friendships and communities built up, but they tend to be built up in the lecture room.
Yes.
Outside of that, students often are not there in the evenings because they're in London or in Essex, and some of them will literally make that commute
morning. It's like a commute, like a job, I guess. Yeah. And then in the evenings, they go back to their families or they go to their part-time bar job or whatever. Yeah. It's very different for us, I think.
And also, Lampeter, then people would travel literally from the other side of the country, from Essex or from Scotland or overseas. Whereas it is, now that students pay their fees, it's often the case that they will stay bit closer to home. I mean, most of my students are Kent, Essex, South London. And then when you have a student from, and there are a few of my students from Wales, which makes me feel very proud to be Welsh, in a way that I don't feel that I don't sound it when I'm in Cardiff. But because of that, you have this huge kind of, there was this huge diversity in Lampeter, so you'd gone to a very far-flung West Wales town, but then you'd be talking to somebody from Rochdale, somebody from Tyne and Wear, and it was like, how did that happen? And so, you know, when I was in Cardiff, I was thinking, every person has a Cardiff accent, moved to Lampeter, and it felt really rich.
Like
and
a melting pot.
Yeah,
definitely. I remember there was a guy in our first year, because we joined at the same time, didn't we? I think he might have lived, I can't remember now, either in Burgess or maybe Loy Tom. Very, very tall guy, and he was called Sean.
Sean.
He was the
from Newcastle or Sunderland.
Yeah, he was a Geordie. A big, gentle giant. Lovely guy. Spent quite a lot of time with him and his mates in the first year. And I remember him arriving, you know, the first weekend of every term, and I literally needed one of those Douglas Adams Babel fishes to put in my ear to understand. Because I grew up in South Devon, so, you know, I was like, oh my God, from where he came from was like the Arctic Circle to me. Yeah. But then by the end of the term, his Geordie would sort of soften, I'd get my ear in, we'd understand each other a bit better, and then he'd go home for his holidays and come back, we'd have to start again.
Yeah,
I wouldn't have had that exposure to all those diverse accents and types of people.
No, I felt every time I was on was blushing because he was on the same corridor as me, and he was a lovely chap, very tall, and almost and he was in a room where the ceiling was too low for him, and he was banging his head. But the accent was the problem because I was always saying pardon. And he never picked me up on it. He never said, you know,
He was a very sweet guy.
He was a lovely chap. But it also showed, and this is why I think maybe I stayed in Lampeter so long, because I kind of felt the world was coming to me. Because sometimes you want to spread your wings. And
build
you want
it
to
and they will come. But a field of dreams.
Well, if only. Well, actually, I suppose Lampeter had, well, Magic Mountain was the eye of a cornfield.
I've gone down that on a refect tray in my time. Have you? Do you remember when it used to snow? We used to go and steal the refect trays, and they'd be going around campus doing raids on all the halls to get all the trays. I remember at the end of every academic term, because I worked in the Union Bar for all of my second year and all of my final year, and I'm quite proud of this. When Ron went on holiday, just after we had done all of our exams in our fourth year, he'd kind of very kindly, he'd trained me up. He'd been like my sort of first professional mentor. He trained me up, and I ran the bar for a couple of weeks whilst he went off with Debs, and they had a holiday, and we had some brilliant lock-ins. But I remember at the end of every term, we had to go on hall raids and just claim back all the pint pots and all the stuff that, I'll hold my hand up. I was probably the biggest tea leaf of all, with all the pint pots and things. And I remember just going around, and we'd like be washing up the glasses, and there'd only be about four left.
Yeah.
And then Ron would go, okay, we have to go on a hall raid.
Yeah.
And we'd come back with boxes of the things. And my hall in the fourth year was probably one of the worst offenders. I lived in JR, so...
Oh, yeah.
Well,
I found, literally soap opera territory in lots of
ways. Yes, it certainly was.
but I found that one of the best memories of being in the Union was actually in the summer, because I sometimes stay in the summer for a little bit. And I remember one year I was working on my dissertation, but it felt like a bit of a holiday, because in the bar, it would stay open until much later.
Yes.
And there would be a TV in the barn. Of course, in those days, some people had their old black and white TVs, myself included, but they'd always put Sky Movies on, so it was like a real treat, because in those days, it was all BBC One, BBC Two, ITV, but then, and I remember Pacific Heights comes to mind, but a whole range of really good Hollywood blockbusters, which at that point, the first time they were shown on TV, and watching them down Lambeth in the summer. So what a strange... Another incongruity, that you're very far west, but it was like my parents never had Sky, so we were really engaging and indulging. It felt a bit of a treat, like you could be, we're in Lambeth in the summer, but in the evening there was something to look forward to.
Yes.
And that was the strange thing, that a lot of my friends from school in Cardiff thought, why would you want to go all the way west? Because I was from the city, and it seemed a strange route to sort of go somewhere really quite rural.
Mm.
But actually, that wasn't my sense. I may have outgrown the place after a decade, but certainly those first few years, it was the people who make the place.
Yeah, definitely.
And I think, and the diversity was such that it really felt like such an enriching cultural experience. And I feel I started growing up at the age of 18.
Yeah, I do too, actually. I think the whole thing of going away from home and, dare I say it, I don't want to offend anyone, but sort of doing it properly is going a long way away, so that you don't have your mum and dad to do your washing or send you food parcels or just pick up after you. And I think it's quite a ballsy thing to do, and I think definitely sort of going away, as I said earlier, you're sort of rolling the dice a little bit. It's a bit of a gamble, but you immerse yourself in it, and I'm a big believer in that. I don't think you can sort of do something like that half-assed or half-hearted.
Yeah.
But I do appreciate we were lucky in that we had tuition fees paid.
Mm.
We didn't need to worry about that side of things. Had that been the case when we were going, we may have actually had to have stayed closer to home for financial reasons. So I think it clearly changes. I think something like that will clearly change the type of experiences young adults have at university now.
Yeah.
I don't think they will have the same as us.
And I think they're aware that I had it really good in that sense, because you worked in the bar, but that was presumably by choice, in the sense that
I got paid to socialise.
Exactly.
Come on.
Yeah, well, that's
great. I remember, literally, the beginning of term and everyone's loaded from their grants. It was just chaos. But I remember people would literally come in on a Friday night clutching a £5 note and give it to me and go, like, Linda, I've got a fiver, get me hammered.
Yeah.
And it would be my mission. And some of the cocktails we made, me and Ron and that, and my friends Joe and people behind the bar, we would make pint glasses full of just really quite cool cocktails that cost you a fiver, but probably had about 50 quid's worth in, and would get you absolutely hammered. But that was our mission, and I just loved it. It was almost like being not people I know who DJ say this. You sort of at some point you just take a step back and you just observe, and I guess in our case it's probably carnage. What I saw, but I saw happy people having fun, letting go a bit, and I thought, I've helped to do that, and I really, really enjoyed that. And also, I don't know whether you guys knew this, but you remember the jukebox was located in Gough Corner.
I do.
Yes. Well, once you worked behind the bar, you had access to the secret reject button of the jukebox, which was located underneath the bar at the far end, just as you walk into behind the bar, near where the dishwasher was. So, and you had to be quite, sort of, people would get peed off if you were going, I don't want to listen to Metallica 50 times in a row. But you'd sort of very discreetly go, oh, look, something wrong with the jukebox, click, reject that song. So it was a sense of power as well.
Well, I do remember, and also the really incongruous stuff, because in those days, ABBA weren't cool so much in the early 90s. Unlike,
well, they were at Lampeter. Decades,
but they were at Lampeter. So, and of course, there was always the joke, you'd be in Pooh's Corner. And I remember once, it was an Indian special night, and of course, what came on? Chikatika. Or Chikatika. And I thought, the Chikatika song. So,
I remember sometimes my French tutors, the professors, would come in sometimes on a Friday lunchtime for a Diet Coke and a drink and a little jacket potato and poos. And that was quite a big thing for them. And I knew that they would come in. And Friday lunchtimes was one of my day shifts. And as soon as I saw them walking over the bridge where the pipe was, because that's where the modern languages department was, I would go to the jukebox, and because it had the controls, I could override it. And I put on Voulez-Vous by ABBA. Yeah. And I still don't think to this day they ever twig. They'd walk in and Voulez-Vous would come on. Uh-huh. Everyone would just start laughing. Yeah. But they never twigged.
Yeah. And I enjoyed there were times like a Saturday lunchtime when everyone was a little bit probably they did a bit, because they probably spent the night before going around the washing machine
getting drunk by me.
But I remember going in and there were like three songs that for me were just like a little bit different. There was like Minnie Riperton, there was something from Elton John, but it was just, you know, like it wasn't the mainstream stuff, but it was just a little bit quirky. And I remember a few people
loving
were turning
you.
Around loving you, and they were like the first song where somebody tweets, you know. but it was funny because it was just sort of that moment people would think, oh, I wouldn't have chosen this, but actually this is all right.
Yeah.
And it just kind of, it was just that little bit different, that something that would just make you think, how did this happen? And I think that Lampeter kind of had those moments that
definitely.
It just had enough idiosyncrasy, enough eccentricity to make it, you know, really, you could get through those 3 years.
Lampeter's like Neapolitan ice cream. Yeah. It's lots of different flavours all rolled into one, and it's delicious. And you might not necessarily choose it, but when you try it, you really like it.
Yeah.
A Lampeter's like that in so many ways. Yeah. The jukebox. I mean, if you just think back to all the stuff that was on that jukebox.
But that's the irony of
so random.
So back to those friends in Cardiff who said to me, "You know, why would you go all that far westwards?"
Yeah.
The funny thing is, they often stayed in Cardiff, and they may have had good grounds for doing that. They may have been, maybe family members were ill, or but in a way, they were the ones who did something far more parochial, because they were going back to their parents, so they were still in the same position that they were in at school. And they didn't really socialise to the same degree, because their evenings would be spent with their parents in the way that they always had them at school.
Yeah.
So I kind of felt I had my trajectory was the largest one, which is quite funny considering I'm the one who seemed to be sort of being more cautious in my choice. But it just goes, it's, you know, it ain't what you do, it's the way that you do it. And I think
there's another
really,
song that's also on my iPod.
From Boy 3.
Oh my God.
But so Lampeter, so Devon, and also I think there's an Essex connection.
I was born in Essex. I was born in Basildon, or Bas Vegas, as it's now properly called. And my parents moved down to just outside Plymouth in South Devon. I wasn't even a year old, so I don't remember anything of, you know, being born and, you know, initially brought up in Essex. My sister's seven at the time, 7 years older than me, so she remembers sort of the beginnings of her childhood there. And my father had got a job at a regional TV station, ITV regional TV station, which was Westward Television, which then became Television Southwest. And he worked in the regional TV industry for, I think, about 30 odd years, I mean, most of his adult life. And that's what brought us down there, because my parents were my mother was born in London. She was born in West Ham, so it caught me. My father was born in Essex, as were his parents. And at the time, they became parents themselves. They were very young. My mum and dad had my sister when they were 18. Mm. They were super young. And people say, it won't work, but they're still together. Mm. Hi, mum and dad, by the way.
Yeah.
I think they celebrate 54 years this year, so it's a huge achievement. And my dad and mum regaled me of all these stories. They were super cool, yeah, young kids back then. They would get so dressed up, even just to go to the pub. You know, I mean, we've got black and white photos, and they look amazing. I think people took a lot of pride in their appearance back then. And I remember them telling us, you know, they were working, they had a young family, and my dad, I think he was going down that way on business, or something had happened, and he realized that for the same money that would buy them a not so big house in the southeast, he could buy a new build, as it was back then, a really nice big house, really close to the sea, close to the beaches. He was thinking of the family, the kids, and there was a bit of a no-brainer, really. Yeah. So they bought the house. My father had started a new job down there, and I'm led to believe that initially he sort of worked down there in the week whilst our house was being built, and then came back to the southeast at the weekend. Mm. But then when the house was ready, they just, back in those days, they hired a van, packed it full, and my dad drove us off down to Devon. And that's where I grew up. So although I have a lot of family in Essex, and ironically, I now live back in Essex myself, I don't class Essex as where I'm from. If I was on University Challenge and, you know, they go, you know, Pike, it wouldn't say Pike Basildon or Pike Essex, it would say Pike Devon, because that's just where I'm from. So for me, going up to Lampeter was similar in that it wasn't a big city, but it was far enough away. And I think because I was lucky to be brought up very close to the sea, it was super close to the Dartmoor National Park, all those things, that slightly more rural setting to me wasn't too much of a hardship.
Yeah.
If anything, I mean, much as I love now, I mean, we're in London today at my headquarters speaking. Much as I love London, and I've lived in London for many years after that, I'm still really a country girl at heart. And I think that's because of where I was brought up.
And I think it's important to have that, because I made that mistake sometimes in thinking that to work and live in the same environment, to work and live is actually, but the journey between the different zones can be far more enriching, because there was a period when I was living in Herne Bay. And so what was really funny is to leave the city of Canterbury to drive through, there's a road, it was called Thorndon Wood Road, and it's like going through a forest.
Oh, it sounds lovely.
And you don't do that, and of course...
Even the name of the road, Thorndon Road.
I remember once I did pull over during the snow, and I put up this picture, and it looked like something that, you know, was some masterly sort of, you know, snow in heaven sort of, you know, picture.
Yes.
And then you come out of the forest and you'd enter the seaside. And so for me, that commute, the 15-minute commute to look for the, because along the way, you kind of felt you were going through all the different zones. So it wasn't a case of in Lampeter, I guess I was often going home at lunchtime to have something to eat because I was just down the road. But I think the importance of the commute, and London is, I feel the same way. I love coming up to London. I might do things like we're doing today. I might see a film sometimes. But the important thing is that you go back. Surely not. I know a few. Guess what? I'm sure we'll come. You can interview me and say, Chris, you have. When did your obsession? Was it because you didn't have any in Lampeter for 10 years?
I think that's
where
you're
making
started.
Up. Yeah.
Yeah, I think we're similar now.
But it's really funny. But that's the thing. But it's that, I don't know if the word is alterity or counterpoint is the word. Everybody needs that counterpoint. Yes. So you had it with the country. So you feel now you live in the city. But the crucial thing is that you're not defined by it.
Yes.
And you know there's always somewhere you can go.
Oh, yes.
Where you can say, this is home.
Yeah.
And I think, and I also think that's why a place like Lampeter can really work, because you need that. And it's good character building, but I agree
Hugely
with you.
Hugely so.
But it's the people, not just the place.
Definitely.
As well. So if people ask me where I'm from, the answer is Cardiff. But I know that so much of my growing up was in a much wider kind of, you know, Lampeter and beyond. And it's funny when you then meet those people outside of that environment, like we're doing today in London, because we realise that we're talking about Lampeter very freely. We're nowhere near Lampeter, but that's our sort of go-to thing.
It's ingrained in us some ways, isn't it? I think all of us that have been there, and thanks to social media, although there are some very bad aspects of social media, but I'm quite old-fashioned and purely use it to keep in touch with people. You know, if you talk to anybody, within 5-10 minutes, Lambda will come up in conversation. And it's something that bonds us all. And I think we've all got, I think our experience overlap. And that's another thing, even though we were there at the same time. And there weren't that many of us at Lambda. I remember my first year, I had a T-shirt I bought at one of the rag shows, which said, free the Lambda 900, you know? And I was really proud of that T-shirt. But even though it was very small, we all still do have very different experiences and different friendships. But they do overlap, and I think that's the uniqueness of Lambda, is that we've all got our own very different take on it,
but that's
but they
what
all overlap.
But in the same way, I remember once being on a tube train in London when at some point, maybe it was going to a conference, and I was going back to Lambda that evening, and I worked out there were probably more people on that train, than in the whole of Lambda. And I thought that, and that was a sobering realisation.
And I got most of them drunk.
but I mean, earliest memories, though. I mean, you mentioned growing up in sort of Devon.
Oh, as a child.
What were the things that you really enjoyed doing?
Oh, gosh. Well, I to me, they're very ordinary things, but it's because I think I had a very happy childhood. I think I'm very lucky in that respect. Like I said, my mum and dad have been married an awfully long time. And that's always been something very important to me, is having that very sort of close, solid family unit. So we're a very close family. We still are, thankfully. And growing up, you know, my mum and dad were young parents. Like, looking back now, being older, I think, blooming heck, how did they do it? Because they were 18 when my sister came along. I think my dad was 19, to be fair. My mum was 18. My mum was only 25 when I came along. You know, I think I've got jumpers older than that. Do you know what I mean? And yet they were having two children. They bought a house. They're both working, you know, having careers. And they didn't have an awful lot of spare cash, but I never felt as a child that we wanted for anything. And my earliest memories are sort of quite random ones. I remember, I think my mum and dad still have it now. I had this giant, or to me, a giant lion. He's actually only about this tall, so he's only about a metre tall, but when you're two, that's
it's
like
a 6-foot monster,
and he was called Leo, because I'm very imaginative with my with my animal names. And I just remember I was obsessed with a bobble hat at the time, and probably a bit like Kenny off of South Park, you know, I just wouldn't take this blooming hat off. And I just remember one of my earliest memories is me sat on the lounge carpet with my arm around my lion and my bobble hat on, and my dad taking a photo. And that's one of my first memories. And it's nothing, so it's not an amazing memory, it's not the most beautiful memory ever, but it's just something really strong. That
and is it the photograph or the memory, or have the two been inextricably interwoven?
The two together. I can literally feel my fingers touching my cuddly lion's fur, and I'm a very I'm a kinesthetic person. I remember things purely by how they make me feel, and that might be sort of an emotional response, or it could be I can feel something. And whenever I go to the sea, even now, I mean, I'm lucky, I live very close to the sea again, so most weekends when it's decent weather, I'm either walking on the beach, or I'm swimming in the sea, or we're paddle boarding, and we're doing all sorts. As soon as I get to the seaside, no matter where I am, the first thing I do is I take my shoes and socks off. And I've got to get my feet in that sand, and that grounds me. So it's things like that which make me remember a feeling. So I remember that sort of fluffy touch of the lion, and also the click and the flash of the camera. My dad had one of those old Pentax ones, which probably worth a fortune now, but you know, those are the things about that. And I remember also swimming. My dad would take my sister and I swimming on Sundays, and it was a real treat to go, because my father worked very hard when we were growing up. He worked a lot of shift work, and some days he wouldn't be there for either breakfast or for dinner, depending on what shift he was on. So if he wasn't working at a weekend, and we'd been good all week, you know, our big treat was to go swimming with my dad. My mum's not a keen swimmer, but she would always come and watch, you know, from the balcony overhead. And one of my first long-term memories, which goes a lot through my childhood, was, you know, just being really happy swimming in the pool with my dad and my sister, And I was, you know, still quite weeny at that point. And my dad taught me to swim, and this is so clever. My dad taught me to swim by, you know, those orange armbands that all the kids had. Well, I'd go into the girls' change room to get ready with my mum and my sister. And then I'd go down to the poolside, and my dad would, like, firmly, you know, put them on, and they, you know, they're a bit hard to get on and off. And I didn't realise, but over several weeks, if not months, he was slowly putting less and less air in. And I didn't realise. So I was just happily splashing around. And I remember the day when I was splashing around, and they were flapping around me, and my dad actually coming up to me in the water and saying, you know, there's no air, and I promptly sank. That was a big lesson to me. It's all in your mind, and I didn't realise at the time. And again, my dad and I have spoken about this in years gone by, and he said, it's all in the mind. You thought that those were holding you up, so you were swimming. As soon as I told you that there was nothing in them, you sank.
I had the same with the bike. With stabilisers. Are the stabilisers on? Yes. And of course I looked and they weren't on, and I probably fell over.
That's exactly what my dad did. And again, my dad may have been a bit more gentle in that respect. He kept them on, but he was making them a bit higher, so they weren't quite on the ground.
I should qualify that by saying my dad was actually holding the bike. I didn't actually like suddenly have this massive
accident.
But he was very carefully, you know, aware that I needed that comfort zone. I needed to know that I was safe.
But I needed
to spread my wings.
It sounds like our fathers were quite similar in that respect. Just remember that was a real big childhood memory. And being tiny and just paddling around in the pool, and it just being the best thing in the world. And you know, I'm a water baby to this day. I do a lot of, you know, diving and stuff with my husband. And I think it's because very early on, my dad had introduced me to the water, told me not to be afraid of it. And we used to muck around something chronic. And those, for me growing up, those were the happy days. Or being at the beach in the summer and doing the same thing there, you know, with my family. And sometimes we'd have, you know, grandparents with us or other friends and family. Those to me were the happiest times, and they still are, even though, you know, life has changed a lot now, and you know, I'm very blessed. I've got a great life, but for me, the happiest I ever am is very simply by the sea, either sat on a chair by the sea, or just lying by the sea, or swimming in the sea. And I think it does go back to my childhood and being close to the sea, going to the seaside at weekends and school holidays, and having that early introduction to the water to not be afraid of it. Yeah. That did temporarily stop when I saw the Jaws film, when I was probably too young to see it when it came out. That terrified the bejesus out of me. Yeah. And I didn't want to go in the sea for a little while after that, but I got over that.
Yeah, no, I definitely like the idea of the sea. Maybe not actually going in it, but then again, when I was living in Herne Bay, of course, you used to dip your feet.
You do go for a little paddle.
My children love, you know, hold them back, you know.
So
they've really, in a way that I didn't do that sort of thing when I was younger, really. But what about music? Influences,
because obviously. Have you got?
But as I remember, because I recently put something up on Facebook, which is the putting up these old charts I used to write down.
That. Yeah, that's amazing.
And it happened to be that, of course, your name appeared in the Hugh and Price song. So it was this very week, 1989. There we are. But absolutely, and trust me, because in those days, see, this is the funny thing. I think there was a part. It turns out, as I just discovered from the last few days, people were like, oh yeah, I remember that folder that you had in your. And I was like, did I really show everybody that? Because my sense is that I was also a little bit embarrassed. I suppose it was a bit too close to something. It felt a little bit nerdy. Because now you move forward 30 years and you think, that is so, like, did I really do all that? And
That's
I'm so
amazing.
Proud of that.
Yeah.
But I used to be a little bit embarrassed of it. But for me, that sort of ritual on a Sunday, 5 o'clock, writing down the charts.
Yeah.
But did you share anything like that?
Oh, gosh. I tried to do what you did. And failed after about 4 weeks because I just didn't have the patience, and I didn't have as neat a handwriting as you, I have to say. And I love the fact that you colour coded them as well. I thought that appeals to me because I'm very like that. I'm very logical and geeky. Yeah. Maybe that's why I'm a project manager these days. That really ticked all the boxes for me. But my sort of Sunday evening ritual when I was growing up was I remember. my father and I listening to, actually with my mum and my sister as well, the Douglas Adams Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, when that was on the radio. Absolutely loved that. And I remember being introduced to that by my parents and then watching the TV, the original TV series and all the rest of it. But I think for me, in terms of my own ritual, it was, and I'm sure loads of people that grew up in the 70s and 80s like us would have the same, where you'd have your cassette recorder and you'd sort of hold it up to the radio with your record and play fingers ready to press those buttons. And I would religiously do that. And then you'd spend a little bit of time trying to sort of cut out where the DJ spoke. And then you'd have your mixtape for the week and you'd play it with your mates. And then you would, I don't know if you did this, but it might be a girl thing, I don't know, but we would then take those tapes and then we'd all be around at each other's houses and each other's bedrooms and what have you, and we'd then try and learn the lyrics, so we would play the tape and then press pause, write it down.
I did do that.
And between us, we'd try and get all the lyrics and then we'd spend all week like learning our favourite songs so that when it came on, we were so cool and we could sing it word for word. And some of those songs now, if you ask me what I had for tea last Wednesday,
I can't remember.
Can't remember, but some random song that will come on the radio from 30, 40 years ago, I will probably remember all the words, and my husband looks at me like, you're not normal, because there are things day to day that I really do not remember, but that, and it just goes to show what an important part of you growing up that was.
But I wonder if my professional career as well has always been about this interplay between the kitsch or the trivial and the, you know, the existential, because that is defining. On paper, literally on paper, you just think, well, this is just somebody writing down something on the radio. But remember, in those days, of course, we didn't have social media.
We didn't have any of that.
And also, the skill that you learn, you know, from writing, I mean, of course, these, I think I did have Smash Hits magazine in those days, so you'd have the lyrics.
Smash Hits.
But writing, but you say stopping it, writing it down. Without realising it, when I went to Lampeter, and even now in the job I'm doing, the way that I process information is kind of no different from what I was doing in those days, because it's the commitment. The crucial thing is that every week without fail, I would write that down,
do
I would telecode it.
Yes.
And I did that over so many years until New Kids on the Block came along, and I thought, what is this?
And
suddenly I thought, this isn't me anymore. And it was funny how that really happened. 1990, and it was like, not for me.
R.I.P. the folder.
Yeah, well, kind of. But in a way, since then, I may not have been interested in the contemporary charts, but of course the whole nostalgia interest, because I may not have continued to add every week, but the material that was in the ones that I did do has taken on a sacred quality.
Yeah. I went to the, what's it called? I'm going to get this wrong. The museum that's next door to the Natural History Museum in London is the, is it the British Science Museum? And on one of the floors there, they have a long one. It's a massive hall. I mean, you'd need a week to go and see everything that's in there. They've got this massive glass case, a huge thing. And it's got every kind of sort of a good invention, something that's become ubiquitous and part of our beings in there. And it goes back a long way, but if you walk up to it and start looking at it sort of mid-70s, you go, oh my god, we have one of them. And then you see like a ZX81 appear, and then an Atari, and your folder needs to go in there, because everything that I took, I was there the other week with some of my friends, my oldest school friend actually, from my time in Devon, and we were there with her children who are at primary school, and we were showing them, and they were like, oh my god, look at all this old stuff. But to us, trip down memory lane, and your folder kind of needs to go in somewhere like that.
I've also always kept a diary, and I realized that I've I've been collecting with that, because it's also something that you do day by day. You don't think, oh, I wonder what somebody will make of this in 20, because that's what, also I'm writing it for myself. I don't have, it's not as though I'm writing it for a particular person.
You're not putting
person.
It on, you're not blogging it or anything, are you? It's private.
It is, but also I guess there's, I kind of know that at some point in the future, at some point, posthumously, or that somebody will find that useful. Also, I'm aware that potentially it's, you know, well, I don't know if it's libel. I mean, it's certainly a breach of privacy. Let's put it that way. In its, you know, in its present form. But the crucial thing is that it's a day by day account, and then to see those patterns and look back and think, oh my word, how did that happen? Or you realise that at the time something was sweet and innocent, and then you realise that maybe you put trust in somebody, or, you know, there's all sorts of dynamics, and having that consistent record through time means that you've got this incredible ability to survey your own life, an overview of your life. Because like with a film or with a record, at the time you might think, oh, this is a bit rubbish, or you might think this is the best song ever. And of course, years later, you'll have a different apprehension of that. But the crucial thing is that if you wrote in your diary at the time, this is the best thing I've ever heard, or whatever, well, that whatever has happened subsequently, and what other people may have said or influences in your life, that's like the authentic
record. Yeah, in the moment, that was how it was.
And then, so even writing down the charts, that's a real sense of that is what I did. And of course, it's not just the having those records. Of course, that epitomises a certain period, because I was doing my GCSEs in that period in 1989. So of course, and I wonder if it kind of helped me revise as well, because in doing all of those things, writing it all down with the colour coded, I was also sitting on the end of my bed researching for my exams.
You're doing your study notes.
Although I kind of felt I always had to be defensive, as in, oh, you're writing down the charts and you've got an exam next week, but actually I do think it was putting me in the right mindset. But I can see that now, 30 years on, in terms of what I'm doing now. At the time, you know, I couldn't see that far ahead. My mum was 46 when I went to Lampeter. I'm now 46. So in that sense, when you look at it from a different generational perspective, you think, you know, that is something quite, you know, compared to what somebody at the same age might be doing now. So I'm really proud of that. But it sounds like you had a very similar kind of
background. I think people of our generation, I think that's fairly common, isn't it? We were all, I mean, you know, back then, the Sunday evening charts, top 40, that was big. And Top of the Pops on a Thursday night, you know, it was a real big deal to watch that.
And can you remember what the first record was that you ever bought?
Oh, gosh. Now, I knew you were going to ask me this, and I genuinely can't, because I do struggle a little bit with a recall in terms of physically doing something. Yeah. I've just always been a little bit absent-minded, I guess, like that. But I'm thinking, I could be wrong, but I think it might have been, I'm going to bow my head in shame here. I remember my sister gave me Duran Duran, Seven and the Ragged Tiger. That's the first album I remember being like properly mine, but I didn't buy it, I was given it. I can't remember myself the first album I bought, but I think it might have been Aha, their first album, which was called Take On Me. I think after the single that they released, but it was around about that time. But again, with Seven and the Ragged Tiger, I got that for Christmas. Can't remember what year it came out, 80 something, and I remember having it on cassette and not really understanding what the title meant. Seven and the Ragged Tiger, still don't really get it. And but what was really amazing was when you unfolded the little insert from the tape, all the lyrics were inside, and they were written in the tiniest font. Back then, when you were young, I couldn't do it now, I have to get my glasses on. But I thought, oh my God, you know. So that was, yes, excellent. So I remember that, and also being quite touched that my sister knew me well enough to actually have gone and chosen that for me, because I didn't ask. I mean, my mum and dad and that, when we were growing up, we didn't get the, okay, give me your top 20 things you want for Christmas. We basically got what we got. But my mum and dad are very, you know, very kind people, and took a lot of time and effort to choose nice things for us. They always, you know, I'm lucky, I never got rubbish presents. And I just remember being really chuffed that, I'd got this Duran Duran cassette, because I was in primary school and we were all into Duran Duran. But also just being really quite touched that my sister, who was 7 years older than me, had thought that much to go and get me that. And when I was growing up, me and my sister being that much older than me, we didn't actually have an awful lot in common until I then became older myself. So, you know, when I was at primary school, she was at secondary school. And I remember I'd gone to the same primary school as her. So I had the first 3 years of my school career being called Paula, because all of our teachers were the same, and they couldn't get used to there not being a Paula Clegg, but there being a Linda Clegg. You know, so I was actually, I genuinely, even now, I think that was just really cool that she thought that much of me.
But also the physicality of the experience. Because you'd actually, in those days, she would have to have walked
into... Woolies or somewhere. Woolies.
And physically bought that product for you. Yeah, and it's a bit too easy now, because you think, oh God, it's the birthday tomorrow, I better be quick.
Amazon Prime, it will still get there.
And that's okay. But also the effort then, and also you with the pocket money and going into Woolworths or Our Price, whatever it might have been in those days, and handed over the money at the counter.
Yeah, it was was a big deal, wasn't it? And I think, again, with people maybe more of our generation and older, that still resonates today. I mean, with my close sort of friends, we are spread out sort of around and about now. But when it comes to sort of birthdays and things like that, we're going to buy each other something. We actually keep it until we're going to see that person and give it to them then, so that there's more thought that's gone into it, rather than, oh, like you say, like the night before, I'll Amazon Prime her something and get them to wrap it. Yeah. You know, we still want to be thoughtful and personal in our presence. Yeah. And that was really important.
And I think because in those days you couldn't wing it in that way,
there's something
really special, because it's too easy now that you can give somebody the idea of a present or a sort of you don't actually see what the person is opening because you haven't wrapped it.
Or in some cases it might be really awful. I mean, I'm quite sort of choosy. That'd be really awful wrapping paper, you know. And also, you know, I think my friends think most of us know each other well enough now to go, she would never have chosen that wrapping, or she wouldn't have chosen that card. Yeah. So, you know, like your Moonpigs and things. Yeah. I might be missing a point with Moonpig, but when I have, on the rare occasion, ordered a Moonpig card because it's been personalised for something, you know, quite specific, I then have Moonpig send it to me so I can then write in it.
Yeah.
And then I put a stamp on and post it, because I just don't want a computer to print, you know, a card, and then print my words in.
Do you know, I'm something you've made me think of something, because
call me
a few. Well, a few people have said to me, "Why do you physically go to meet people to interview them? Why do you do it over Skype?" And I'm like, "What?" For me, that's it's like, well, why would I do that? I need to get in that car or get on the train and do it. And it's like, you know, trust me, that is an absolute pleasure. But of course, there's all the other things you can do around it anyway. Was it after or before we started recording? Going to Scarborough to interview one of our Lambeth contemporaries. Now, I would never have found myself in Scarborough, because it's completely outside my province, you know. And so the interviews have allowed me to visit to places that I would never otherwise have gone to. But also, it's the same thing as writing down the charts. Mm. Like, these days, you would just print it out. Or you wouldn't print it out. It would be on the screen. You wouldn't even need to print it. It would all be there for you. And you know, it's never going to go over as then. It felt like, if I miss it on the Friday, I may never get it again. Because in writing it down at that moment, you were somehow concretizing this very important experience. Because you knew that the artists at the time were listening. Mm. That they would find out at the same time as us what was number one. Because I have no idea what happens anymore. It's all on a Friday.
It's not even on a Sunday anymore now. I mean, gosh.
Yeah,
so, Friday night. Yeah. Whose idea was that?
But also, and I always joke, because I've got young children, but I have no idea what... I've looked it up, but I've since forgotten. I have no idea what was in the charts when they were born. But I can easily sometimes work out. Somebody was born in the 80s or something. I'll say, I think it was Diana Ross, Chain Reaction. Mm. They're like, how did you know that? It's like, well, it's just a process of elimination.
Oh, God, I hate that song.
Yeah.
That used to be on one of the aerobic classes I used to do back in the day, and that was one of the songs, and I hated aerobics. Yeah. So any song that was on that play track that the teacher used to use.
Although even to this day, there is one line, I remember that there was something on the radio, it was called Twisted Lyrics. I think Bruno Brooks did it in the evening, and it would be songs that have, where the lyrics sound different to what they're supposed to be. And to this day, I'm not joking, I think that there's a line, I don't know what the actual line, I actually don't want to know, because this is far better than the original, and it's "Tell Eddie Waring there's no salvation." And Eddie Waring was sporting presenter or something like that. I don't know. Some in the 60s, in the 70s, in the UK,
was that a bit like which
Diana Ross, you know, would not have been singing about. But it was the incongruity of that.
And
I prefer that
completely
absurd
too.
Lyric.
I used to sing Sue Lawley to the Sting song,
the
police song, rather than So Lonely. To me,
of
it was
course,
Sue Lawley.
Yeah.
And then we said it earlier on, Chicken Tikka.
Yeah.
The other song. Sometimes those wrong lyrics are actually better.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. They actually elevate the song. It's like, actually that song, because you personalise that song.
Yes.
You've made it speak.
Then it's
to
an
you.
Earworm, and you can't ever not hear that again, can you?
Yeah. You have an investment. Yeah. I like writing it down. But in terms of your profession now, because obviously you did French, didn't you? At
Lampeter. Yes, I did.
But,
yes. Oui, monsieur.
But what are you doing now? Because we're in your place of work at the BT Centre in St Paul's. But how did you get from there to here?
Oh my gosh, I still don't really know. When I was at Lampeter, like I said, in my final year after I'd sort of done my exams, I ended up running the Union Bar for a little bit, and that was great. And I then joined. Bass taverns, as it were, back then, under the graduate training scheme. And there were two routes in it. I became a licensee, and at the time I was the second youngest licensee in the country. Back in those days, I was only 20, just turned, no, I was like coming up to 22, so just 21. And normally back then, they would only give a justice license to you if you were 25 or over. And I was a woman. Oof. I was single. Oof. And I was under 25, so I had all these things going against me, because it was quite a traditional trade back then. But I went into that because I had been given the option to become a regional business manager doing the graduate training scheme that way, where you get your suit and your company car. And I just thought, I kind of need to walk the walk before I talk the talk. And I just thought, people aren't going to respect me if I'm literally out of nappies coming along in my, what, Ford Sierra, it probably would have been, telling them how to run their business. So I thought, no, I need to learn the business myself. And because Ron had been kind enough to sort of give me a little bit of an inkling as to what that might be, and I liked it, I was good at it, the people aspect definitely appealed to me. I thought, right, I'm going to do the other route. And so, long story short, I did that for a while. Then I went into business development purely because the regional business manager at the time had noted I was good at developing businesses and people and understanding stuff. And I've got I think it's just part of who I am. I'm very good at problem solving, but in a creative way. You know, don't give me a Sudoku or a Times cryptic crossword. I wouldn't do that, but I'm quite creative in thinking. So I went more along those lines, and then I ended up being seconded out to Italy. So I worked in Italy for a few years, and this was after my degree, and then I ended up coming back to the UK, and I started working in BT. And originally I came in as an executive assistant, looking after one of the very senior people within the company. And I was a kind of a chief of staff figure for that person and their line of business and all of their senior leadership team. And it was really interesting because the person I worked with was very inclusive, which was nice, very old school, but wanted people to he wanted people to work with him rather than him just tell people what to do. So we had a really good team, and that gave me a good insight into how my company works in a corporate sense, and the routes to doing things, because we have such a large company here, knowing what to do and how to navigate is often the trickiest part. And then from there it just sort of morphed, and again, working in a large company, you have the possibility to develop and have many different careers within the same company, and you have the continuation of employment. So things sort of morphed to the point where I was running projects for him. And he just basically said, you know, you've kind of, a bit like you're saying about outgrowing things, you've kind of outgrown this role now. Off you go, little bird. And I became a project manager sort of officially. So moving away from more of the sort of business support, administerial kind of role, and moving into being a project manager myself. And I now work within the security part of BT. And that's not, your name's not on the door, you can't come in. That's the sort of information technology and the cybersecurity that keeps about 80% of our country's infrastructure going. And it was purely curiosity that brought me there, because I thought, okay, big company, I need to kind of, I wanted to learn some new stuff. And I'm not, you know, technically trained at all, but every day, literally every day, I'm learning stuff, which is great. But I bring a slightly different perspective to the table, in that I'm not technically trained. So often I will be on a call with lots of different people who are really geeky and clever, and I'll be the one that finds the problem that none of them have thought of, because they're siloed and they only do their bit, which is fine. And I'm kind of, I liken it to being like a conductor, and I've got an orchestra in front of me, and they've all got their own important part to play, and I have to orchestrate, conduct, make things happen, and then out the other end will come, you know, a product or a deployment of something for a customer. It's a really convoluted way. I can't really tell you how or why. There haven't really been any light bulb moments. The only real light bulb moment I can genuinely recall is when I worked behind the bar and Ron let me loose on it properly for a couple of weeks, and I got all the takings right. I got all the ordering right. Everyone had a great time. The takings were up. I did some bar promos and got rid of loads of old stock that Ron didn't want, and he just came back and went, "Babs," because that's what we used to call us. He goes, "Babs, you're a bloody genius." Yeah. And that's when I thought, ah. But I think maybe the underlying thing with me, or maybe the thread, is that most of what I do is very people focused. Yeah. Even now, I work in a very technical environment, but I'm known as, within my sort of part of the business, as being the people person. If there's ever any difficult conversations or something, give that to Linda. Yeah. She'll sort it out. And my old boss used to call me the terrier, because he said, "I'm very tenacious, and if there's anything on my radar, if there's a problem that can't be solved, I will get to the bottom of it."
Yeah, no, I have always been a people person, in the sense that there was once a job I had to do, which was always, it was like a learning and teaching type role. We were always looking at module specifications, and always, and you know, somebody has to do that. Mm. But I kind of felt that I was always looking at what other people had written, and I was effectively saying, "Yes, the assessment for this module is, you know, needs to be altered a little bit because it needs to be differentiated from the students a year above," and all that sort of thing. But it felt very heartless, and it's an important job to do. But did it feel like the right job for me when I was senior tutor? You know, students were coming to me in crisis, in need, and they were often leaving with a smile on their face, because it was like, "Oh, you're not judging me, or you're not sending me home. You're not saying you have to leave the university because you didn't give that essay in." Mm. And I think that you realise sometimes that you have particular attributes or skills, which, you know, sometimes other people point them out to you. Mm. But it is like being a conductor. I like that analogy, the idea that you're putting... You know, you're the one who ensures that it works. Yes. You might be, in my case, I might be teaching the students, but you're aware that whatever's happening, whatever divergences there are, we have to finish at a certain point.
Yes.
And you have to make sure everybody in the room is accommodated, so you don't suddenly, people leave and think, "Hang on a minute, we didn't cover all the ground."
Yeah.
So you have to allow for those flights of fancy, which sometimes get everybody really excited. It's like the teachers at school who go off curriculum, and they have these great debates. I remember my English teacher did that. They're wonderful, because what you remember is not what you were reading that week, but the conversation around it. But you need the two in balance.
You do.
And I feel that that can be great. In a technical environment, you need somebody who can actually just see the wider picture and ensure that everybody is given a reason for getting through that day.
Yeah.
And rather than just a sort of, we're doing this because there's a job on the screen that needs doing, there has to be some kind of point to it, some goals, some telos, which it sounds like you're doing in spades.
Yeah, it is. That's exactly what I have to do. I mean, I have to understand enough about the technology with which we're working to be able to work with these very clever people that do the real, you know, the real nitty-gritty stuff. But it's not my job to know it as well as them. My job is to look at what they're doing in relation to the next person or the person after that, and to spot problems before they happen, and also when something might go wrong, pick up the phone to the customer, you know, be the face, as it were, and also be the go-between. So it is it's a bit of diplomacy and tact. It's a little bit of sort of being logical, being able to take a step back and look at something and creatively problem solve, and also to foresee things. Often when we're preparing a particular project to be implemented, you know, we have to think of all the what ifs, you know, and so if I have to think of every little thing that may go wrong, what would I do about it, and make sure all those things are put in place. So there's a lot of sort of people softer skills that go with still doing a technical job.
And you feel in that sense that, I mean, this to me is crucial. I think also is a question that I ask certainly people in my profession when I'm interviewing them, is it's that sort of what makes you get up at whatever time you get up in the morning. Because for me, a lot of my colleagues tend to, inverted commas, work from home. I find that an anathema. I have to be, I mean, I have my own office, it's wonderful, and often I need my space. I can't do the job I do unless I have that space sometimes. But the important thing is there's always a community, there's a hub around, and the sense that I'm involved in that rather than on the periphery of it. And I think that whatever job I ever do, or I've been in one profession forever, but I sort of sense that that is the thing that I would always gravitate towards, and I kind of like that. So other people sometimes might feel, "Oh, you don't have to go in every day." It's like, yeah, I do, actually I do. That's the, and also then in doing that I can do all the other things, like the cinema trips of an evening, because it feels the day is really well balanced.
Spent,
but do you have that? Because I've got Probably more questions than we have time, but I'm going to ask you a more general sort of all-encompassing question, so you can pick the bits you like, which is anything around sport, politics, religion, radio, voting, all sorts of things that, in, you know, anything you want to pick up there that might have defined you, or the things that make you think, this is the cause I believe in, these are the things, whether at university or later. You mentioned swimming, or, you know, something that you were interested in when you were younger, but are there particular things that sort of define you outside of work that make you think, this is what makes me passionate?
Scuba diving, definitely. Yeah. I remember quite a long time ago now, some colleagues of mine at work, and we were in like a business meeting, all suited and booted, and I was about to go off on a diving holiday, and somebody just said, oh, so what are you up to at the weekend? I said, oh, I'm flying off to Egypt. I'm going on a diving liverboard safari. What's that then? What are you going to do? So I'm going to go off. I'm going on a shark safari. I'm going diving with sharks. And they were like, what? So there was this sort of moment where somebody realised that the person they saw in front of them in a suit, being very professional, has a whole other... It's like being a superhero, you know. By day, she's a project manager. Yeah. By night, you know. So and that was something that we actually ended up sort of bonding over, because they then got into scuba diving, and their kids are now into scuba diving. Yeah. So for me, definitely sort of diving, being by the sea, being either on it, in it, or under it, for me is hugely defining in a way. And it's also, it's on many levels as well. It's my happy place. When you're underwater diving, you don't get emails and phone calls and all that rubbish, so you can completely disengage, which is really beautiful and powerful, and you live in the moment. So many times now, I think we're all beginning to live through our screens, even to the point where, you know, I've been guilty of it too, but I'm pulling myself back from it now, where you've maybe been at a concert or seeing something amazing, and you're seeing it through your screen rather than seeing it. Whereas, you know, when you're underwater, you don't have all of these distractions.
Many people in my profession have said the same thing, that they have interviewed a few people, and they're into, and actually quite serious water sports as well. And, you know, in terms of maybe diving, or it might be actually going out in the water and, you know, catamarans or whatever.
It's very freeing. And for me, it combines my love of nature, love particularly sea life, animals, corals, plants. Love all that. I've become better at photography as a result, because I've got into underwater photography. So I'm kind of still living it through a screen, but it's very different.
But you have to be there to do it. It involves a geographical journey rather than just doing it from your TV screen.
It's always different. It's very interactive, spot on. But it's always very different. I've dived some sites many times, and I know them like the back of my hand. And yet they'll always be different. And also, fish don't do what you tell them. It's not like a dog that you can train to sit. So when you do get a really good photo, you're like, oh, yes. You know, and I've been very fortunate to have seen, you know, things that you see on the Blue Planet. I've dived with some amazing stuff. And also, again, the people aspect. Because when you're doing this kind of thing, it's not a competitive sport. When I was younger, I did a lot of competitive sport, but now I'm older, I can't be bothered anymore. And it's very collaborative. Everybody's looking after each other. You meet an awful lot of people that, again, you might not normally have met. Lots of different walks of life. You don't need to be old or young or fit or not fit or fat or thin. You know, scuba diving is very inclusive, and it's a great thing to do as a family as well.
And I found that when I was working with colleagues who would sometimes perhaps really not like their job very much, or you'd associate them with a particular sort of, you know, they never seem very happy, they're always miserable, they're always complaining.
Oh, that's a shame.
But then one of these colleagues passed away, he retired and he passed away, and I went to his funeral, and suddenly I thought, what? Because his son was giving the eulogy. And I thought, if I'd known that his father, my colleague, was interested in, I think opera was mentioned, and he used to do a lot of travelling and photography, and I thought, and cooking and everything, I thought, but I'd love to have had those conversations, but we never did.
Yeah, that's a shame.
And that's the thing I'm getting at, that you see people in a particular workplace and environment, the skills that they have, take them outside of that, and you realise that the thing that defines them... I mean, it's quite funny, because so many people forget or don't know that, I mean, technically, and this is something that I sort of recoil from sometimes. I mean, if I was defined by my job, it would be, what, theologian or religious studies lecturer, where some people would be like, I didn't know you did that. Or they might think, oh, I know you teach, or you're in, you know, but it's, yeah, you're a teacher rather than somebody who is a theologian, which, yes, involves a particular type of practice or research. And yet other people will see me as this person who goes around interviewing, you know, broadcasters. Like, no, I'm not trained as a broadcaster. I can't take that credit. But other people see me as this strange film kind of, you know, because I disseminate myself doing these things. So it's very funny that we wear multiple hats, yeah, often at the same time.
Yes, yeah. About to say the, yeah, same thing. Yeah. It just shows, yeah, that you're, yeah, not... Yeah. People, yeah, are multifaceted. Yeah. We're not, yeah, one-dimensional. Yeah. And I think, yeah, mm, and again, this, this is very important to me, mm, what you're saying, because it shows that you're right. You might have a colleague and you might know him, yeah, as, you know, the theology, yeah, guy. Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, he's someone's husband, father, yeah, son, yeah, friend. There's all this other stuff that this person, you know, does. And I appreciate that some people are private and don't necessarily want to be everyone's best friend at work or whatever. But for me, when I'm working on projects, I try to inject a little bit of humour into, mm, the proceedings, yeah, yeah, or just some informality. You know, yeah, people come on my calls. Yeah. A lot of people come on my calls that don't need to be on my calls, but they come because they know that they're good calls. They're not formal. No one's getting a rollicking. You know, there's a climate, yeah, of forgiveness.
Absolutely. Yeah.
You know, okay, if you've made a mistake or something's not quite, yeah, right, that's fine. Just, yeah, tell me, and we can deal with it. You know, I'm that's the way I work, and I find as a result. Yeah. I get a lot of feedback from colleagues when they say, you know, you ran that project really well because everybody actually enjoyed working on it, yeah, with you, yeah, because I've made it fun, I've made it more teamy.
But that must be so amazing for your self-esteem.
I love it.
And also it makes you do it, because the worst thing
is not,
the people who are miserable, the people who are always complaining, mm, are often then the people you sort of feel, well, if they don't seem to be enjoying their life or their job,
yeah,
so
nice,
we don't enjoy them. So on every level, mm, they seem unhappy, we're unhappy.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, I think it's in my, you sound very similar to me in that sense, like with the students, I get the energy and enthusiasm from them.
Definitely.
And suddenly, I'm not checking my email. I'm not, you know, in the time that I'm with the students, I'm in a very different sort of space. Mm. And it's very, and that is always, without fail, the highlight of the week.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. And even though I work in technology, yeah, I'm a big believer still of pick up the phone, have a chat. You know, there are things within my job which have to be documented and auditable,
yeah,
understood. Yeah. But I'm very much the kind of person, okay, we're all working on a project. Let's pick up the phone and, yeah, talk to each other. That saves 50,000, yeah, emails.
Yeah.
It saves people having keyboard warrior wars, yeah, going on. Yeah. And I just think, do you know what? Did that's your desk? We'll just, yeah, talk about it.
Yeah.
You know, and I have, yeah, luckily very little conflict, yeah, or problems,
yeah,
and people actually now come to me when I'm working on a project, yeah, and say, you know, this thing, well, I've been thinking, and oh, and I'm, yeah, now beginning, yeah, to get people to start to open up, yeah, rather than wait for me to uncover something or tell them,
yeah,
something.
Yeah.
And I prefer working, yeah, that way as a team. Yeah. And also, I'm still very, you know, I kind of metaphorically doff my cap to a lot of the people I work with, yeah, because they are far more technical and, yeah, far more clever than me. Yeah. But I have a different skill.
And I think that's the question. We can't all do the same thing.
We can't, yeah, all be good at, yeah, everything. Yeah. Otherwise, we'd all be butting,
yeah,
all the time, wouldn't we? Or rutting as rams, yeah, do. Yeah. So I think, and I remember when I went for the interview for my current role, it's a few years ago now, and I sort of said, oh, I was quite self-deprecating, which I tend to be. I'm fairly modest, I think, a lot of the time. Even though I might be the loud redhead in the corner, I'm not a big head. I'm just loud. And I remember in my interview sort of saying, oh, well, you know, I'm really interested in working in this part of the company. I think it's where technology is progressing. I'm really interested, but I'm not very technical. And the guy that interviewed me, who gave me the job, said, I don't need technical.
Yeah.
He said, I've got.
You've got enough of those.
I've got enough geeks coming out of my ears. I need someone with your, yeah, with your people skills, yeah, your problem solving, yeah, skills. That's what I need.
Yeah. And here you are after all.
Yeah,
these years.
And I've been in this role for about 5 years, yeah, now, but I'm still learning.
Yeah.
And you know, and every day is, yeah, is good, yeah, because I'm still learning. And,
yeah,
may that always continue. Yeah. Even when I'm old and I don't, yeah, work anymore, I still want to be, yeah, learning,
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah.
I never want to stop.
Yeah.
Whether it be, you know, learning a new recipe. I love baking and cooking. Whether it be learning a new bit of technology, which I did last week. And I actually sort of went to bed that night like, oh, yay, I'm, yeah, so chuffed.
Yeah.
I've actually solved this problem.
Yeah.
I really hope that those kind of things continue. Yeah,
and I've got a few more philosophically based questions in just a second to round off, but I have to ask first film, because you... Oh, we often see
the same thing.
The Good Liar comes to mind as something that we both saw on the day that it came out. And I was just talking to a friend the other day about this, who has a very particular ritual. Mm. And I thought, I should add this into my question. She always says she sits in the back. She always sits in like row N. And I'm thinking, some of the cinemas I go to don't go far as that. I'm definitely not a backseat. I always have to be sort of front to middle. I guess it depends on the cinema. But how important, I mean, that sounds like a really big part of your life, cinema.
Oh, cinema, yes. Absolutely love it. Yeah. I think partly because, spent a few years living a long way away from a cinema in Lampeter. Mm. And I think I said to you before the interview, I remember, being prepared to drive 25 miles to ABBA to go and get, a Wimpy and a strawberry milkshake and then going to see some film in a cinema. And that was a real big deal. I absolutely love film.
Yeah.
It's an escapism.
Yeah.
I love the fact that you can be transported somewhere and have, it's almost like an out-of-body experience.
Yeah,
some of the films that are coming out now are extremely immersive.
Yeah.
I saw, was it last year? Yes, it was last year, to coincide with it being the 50th anniversary since man had landed on the moon. There was a film that came out called First Man. Yeah. That film absolutely wrecked me for about 2 weeks.
Yeah.
I had no idea how bleak and dark Neil Armstrong's life had been and what he had gone through with the loss of his daughter. And the bit when in the film where they're coming into land over the lunar surface, and Franz Hans Zimmer music is playing, that sort of classical music, and it got me. I was in bits. I love how a film can do that, a bit like going to a live music event. I'm kinesthetic. I want to be moved. I want to experience something. I don't want to go to something that's meh, vanilla, bland.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? I want to go and feel something.
Mm.
And I want something, a bit like what you were saying earlier, that it nicely rounds off your day. It's very different. And you feel that you've actually lived quite a full day. If you've got up, you've gone to work, you've done stuff. You've maybe given your daughter a cuddle, done all these other great things, and then you've gone and flown to the moon or been involved in sailing around the world, something really out of what you would do in the form of cinema. I love it, and I'm lucky that my husband loves, this is so embarrassing, the first film we ever went to see as a couple was hilarious, was one of the Muppets films, which I couldn't think of a worse example as the first film, but it was because we were having such a great date. And we didn't want the date to finish. So we thought, how can we prolong the date? Let's go to the cinema. And there was naff all on.
Yeah.
And the only thing that was remotely watchable was like the latest Muppets film.
Yeah.
And that's when I remember sitting in the cinema and his little hand crept over the headrest and sort of armrest and held my hand. And I thought, he's a keeper.
Yeah.
If he'll go and sit through this rubbish film with me.
Oh, yeah. Well, although that said, about the Muppets, because we had a poll at work the other year.
Oh.
It was the best Christmas movie. And
You know exactly which one.
So actually, and I think that isn't as bad a choice as you might think.
No, it wasn't the Christmas film, unfortunately.
Yeah.
So what's your favourite film then?
Well, because I have multiple answers to this, because of course there's always the sort of... Well, of course it's Scorsese, it's Cape Fear, but it is, probably is Cape Fear. But I love...
Oh, with De Niro.
Yeah, because of what he did with the original. It turns the original on its head. So it's the multiple layers.
Yeah.
And it was when I was doing the PhD 20 odd years ago, it was on Redemption and Sin, and that is like the go-to film.
Oh my god!
So it's not Last Temptation of Christ. It is, and Taxi Driver is also a huge one. Shawshank Redemption.
Groundhog Day.
I saw it when it came out. Shawshank Redemption, North by Northwest, Hitchcock. So there's probably a dozen.
Does it change, or do you have sort of a top five, and it'll always be?
Yeah, I give the same answer now as I gave 20 years ago.
Okay,
but many of the films are all from that early to mid, like The Fugitive and In the Line of Fire, but they're all there from that, because they're all films I saw in Lampeter or I was in Lampeter when those Thursday nights.
Silence of the Lambs would be one of my, again it was from I remember Toddy, if you're listening to this, I remember Toddy and I going to Nick's room in Old Building, and Nick was the Ents.
Bradshaw.
Yes, that's it. Thank you. I was struggling with it. I struggle with last names sometimes. Yeah, he was the Ents lead at the time, and we went to watch it in his room. And he had one of those really flash TVs with a DVD player as well. And I've never seen poor Toddish was so scared.
Gina, this is really funny because I wasn't.
That's
there.
A really strong memory.
But I have a strong memory of people. It was that night in his room.
There's quite a few of us.
Because I wasn't there, but I heard the story afterwards. I think that evening, either I bumped into people on the staircase in Burgess, where I was living. Actually, Todd was living in Burgess as well.
Yeah. Toddy was Burgess with me. Yeah. She was the floor below me.
So, and the number of people who were like, we've just seen this really scary film.
No.
But it was many years before. Because Anthony, it was probably year abroad then. It was when I was in my final year. I didn't see him. My film interest really took off after that.
Mm.
But I did see it, Sounds of the Lambs in the Arts Hall, but Anthony Hopkins was given an honorary degree.
Yes.
And he came, and I think he opened the Cliff Tucker Theatre.
He did, he opened it up, and he gave the speech just before lunch. Yeah. And I wasn't there, I was on my year abroad, I would have cut my leg off to have been there. And apparently, a couple of my friends who were there said that he gave the talk, and he apparently, this is all anecdotal because I wasn't there, he opened up the floor to questions.
Yeah.
And somebody said, and this is such a great question, what is the film role that you've never had that you would have liked to have been given?
Yeah.
Guess what he said?
Yeah.
007.
No.
He said at the time, I think I'm too old now, but that's a role that I would have loved to have played.
Yeah.
And then again, somebody said that he was being sort of given the wind-up sign.
Yeah.
And he said, oh, well, you know, thank you very much. Yeah, from blah, blah, blah. Blah. Time to go now. I hear it's time for lunch. And then he leant forward and did the sound.
Yeah.
Oh God! I would have died on the spot.
I love the thought of going to the Refec Lounge with Anthony Hopkins to have the Fava beans and the nice Chianti.
Oh yeah, Chianti's on the menu.
Yes,
amazing. A lot of my favourite films are from similar times. Silence of the Lambs, I loved. And again, I just loved being in the film, watching people like Toddy and everyone else being really scared.
Oh, watching the audience. But one thing I've done, because I go to the BFI quite a lot, and I often choose to watch those films that I missed out on the first time. Like I saw Basic Instinct, because they were all around when I went to Lampeter, but not having seen them at the time.
Mm.
So it's kind of making
up. Sounds a test of time, that film, doesn't
completely.
It?
Completely. Although it was funny, because it was when I saw Fatal Attraction. But that one was. But it was funny, the audience, because Basic Attraction, there was that. Actually, there was that Fatal Instinct. Although there is the Fatal Instinct, which is the spoof. But there were people in the audience, and they were laughing through it. But not but it was more like, that's interesting, because their take on the film made me revisit it after so many years.
It's like a generation later,
isn't
it?
Exactly, and they were like, this is just absurd.
Yeah.
I thought, it is, it's over the top. But it's also meant to be, but it took an audience to be sitting with. Tootsie was another one. I was at the BFI a couple of years ago, and they were laughing in places I wouldn't have expected them to, and it just made me then revisit the film.
Humour changes. Yeah. I'm sure Andy would acknowledge that as well. Humour does. But you think back to some of the... If you ever saw like Jim Davison's sketch on TV now, you'd be appalled, wouldn't you?
I saw him in concert deliberately to see if he was as bad.
Ooh, has he changed?
Well, I thought it was. I wondered whether his performance was all about, you know, his sort of anti-political correctness, and in a way that's kind of his routine. I thought, does he mean it, or is that just his sort of signature in the world? And I thought, no, I think he was authentic. I think that's who he is. And I thought, but I think 20 years ago with Big Break or The Generation Game, he was the face of popular television.
Yeah.
And now he is persona non grata.
Yes, yeah.
But so again, I had to go. But of course, what I was very aware of is everybody there was white. Everybody was of a particular kind of generation.
Mm.
And I did, and at one point, I was only about four rows from the front, and he had this real go at university type Guardian readers, and I thought, he's looking at me.
God.
So again, so I kind of, I'm glad I went, but I really kind of thought, I don't belong here.
Yes, yeah. But you're glad you went, even though
I had to do it to know.
Yeah.
And I...
Like an experiment.
Yeah, I had to know whether it was, you know, the whole performance, and also it's puncturing that...
Definitely.
You know, artifice, that persona. But, a few more questions.
I'm talking about the films now. So I would agree with you on Cape Fear. De Niro is just magnificent in that film.
Yeah.
That is... I've actually got goosebumps just thinking about it. So that definitely... Jaws has to be Jaws. The more I watch it, the more I realise what a dark film, yeah. and it's not really about the shark at all, really. Yeah. And again, I didn't get that the first time.
No, the first time I saw it was in the arts hall, after not at the time it came out. No, well, I saw it in the mid-90s. And I even saw it last year in Ashford at the cinema. Didn't, for some reason, something about it didn't quite connect, and I don't know why that is. Mm. But you're right; it's the atmosphere, it's the mood, it's the whole sort of, it's the fear, rather than, it's not about the shark. It's the idea of the shark.
It is,
and what it generates. People want to make money off it.
It goes back to my dad. It was all about your mind. You know, if you believe you can, you will. Yeah, yeah. If you think there's something in this water going to bite your leg off, it probably will, or it'll stop you from doing something. Yeah. I think also. Oh, do you know the film Leon, the Professional?
Yes, with Natalie Portman.
Yes.
Besson. Yeah,
a very young Natalie Portman. That is. Probably, if I had to choose one, that would be my favourite film, and that's been that way since day one that I saw it. A while ago, I did get hold of a director's cut, which has got this really weird scene in I've never seen before, where Natalie Portman's character and Luc Besson's character, who's the assassin, they go for a romantic date dinner thing.
Yeah,
that kind of ruined the film for me. So I promptly gave away that DVD, and I've reverted back to watching the original.
Yes, that's true. It's difficult to see how it could have been made now in that same way.
Yes, because I was like, oh, I'm a bit uncomfortable with that dynamic. Yeah. I preferred it the other way. So, but that's still in there. And the first film, I know you asked me earlier about the first album, and I was not able to easily recall, but the first film I ever saw in the cinema was the original Star Wars film. Yeah. And this is quite interesting, is that I was 5. Oh. I went with my mum and my dad and my sister, who were all big cinema fans growing up as well, and still are. And I was scared of Chewbacca and thought Darth Vader was just like the bee's knees.
Yeah.
So I got that completely wrong. Yeah. I'm glad to say I have now revised that opinion, being a little bit older and a little bit wiser. Yeah. But I was absolutely scared out of my head by Chewbacca back then, and I thought Darth Vader was amazing.
Yeah.
Isn't that funny?
It is, because I've never... This is the funny thing. You'd be surprised. My students sometimes... Well, they were horrified once when I admitted that. I said, Star Wars isn't really for me, or Harry Potter. So, you know, I go to cinema all the time, because I often seek out those slightly less obvious films. And I will watch the big crowd-pleasing blockbusters, but sometimes for me, they're fine, but there's always something else that is a bit more of an effort. Maybe it's the effort to go to something, sometimes a bit more distinctive, rather than the thing that everybody else is going to see. So what was the first one? I remember going to see Chariots of Fire, which is a funny early memory.
Oh, gosh.
But E.T. certainly, and also E.T., one of the Star Trek films, but I had no idea which one. So that probably would have been very late 70s.
Mm.
I think Superman 3 as well.
My mum took me to see Superman at the cinema. I remember that. And Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. Yeah. I remember my mum took me to see that. Yeah. But I remember back in those days, you would have like a small film to start with, wouldn't you? Like a little Western or...
Yeah.
I hate Westerns. It's about the only film genre I do not like. You're the same, aren't you?
Well, funny, I can appreciate them now. I didn't used to, but I'm okay. I took me many attempts to get to
apart
get
from Blazing Saddles. That's about
or Unforgiven. Unforgiven. I do think is a masterly film, but it's not quite. It's not Eastwood's best by any means. But I can. Get it.
You get it. Yeah. I've just never got on with Westerns. I don't know what it is. Yeah. Maybe it was those half hour Westerns before the main feature when we were kids.
But also, as my mum would always say, that in those days, you'd go into the cinema and because the same film would be showing on a loop, you would just walk in. So it wasn't the case that you had to start, you had to arrive when the film started. You would just go watch the film. Sometimes you'd watch the second half. And then it would finish, and then it would start again, and then you could walk out, which is absurd. But but I remember Chariots of Fire, and we went in, and we must have been early. And we felt that we thought, do we go in now? And we were having a family, I was only about 7, having a debate as to whether we go in, even though the previous, unthinkable now, because there's no way you'd be allowed to do that.
Yeah.
But that was my recollection of going to the film, that you didn't watch it in chronological order. So when I saw Pulp Fiction...
Suddenly
I saw Pulp Fiction, and I realised that, as with anything, not everything in life is beginning, middle, end.
Yes.
Or not in that order anyway.
Yes, that's very true actually. Yeah, those films used to really fox you the first thing, like, hang on a minute, what's going on? Then they'd all cleverly come together. Yeah, he was very good at that, wasn't he, Tarantino?
Yeah.
I remember Pulp Fiction very fondly. That was extremely popular in my last year at NAMPTA, which was the academic year of 1994 into 1995. Yeah. And it was just on the jukebox, either in the Union Bar or up at the Quarry.
Girl, You'll Be a Woman
Constantly.
Soon.
Constantly, yeah.
I saw Neil Diamond at the O2, and because that is his song.
Yes.
Yeah.
Beautiful song.
And he did it in two. He did the two versions. He did the two versions of it. One in his original style.
Yes.
And unless I'm getting mixed up with Red Red Wine, which of course he also did. He did the reggae version of that.
No, he did both. Yeah. Girl, You'll Be a Woman Soon is on Pulp Fiction.
The soundtrack. Yeah.
Oh, I used to love that. Gosh, I remember singing that. Many a time in the Union Bar after a few pints, everyone sort of arms round each other and stuff. Yeah.
Were you allowed to drink when you were working at the bar?
No, not behind the bar. No, and I have to say, hand on heart, we were very good. We didn't do that, but at the end of the shift, we'd always have a drink together. Yeah. You know, which is part of what you
do. Of course you do.
And then sometimes, you know, if people had bought you a drink, then you could have that too, take it home with you, what have you. But yeah, I mean,
as long as you brought the glasses back.
Long, which is something I often fail to do. Sorry, Ron, if you're listening. Even when I was working behind bars, you know, when I was a licensee and then I never drank when I worked. I just can't do it.
Well, it's the same now. And also, I think, because I do obviously cinema trips a lot, but I don't obviously drink because I drive. Mm. But also, it's a great discipline because there's nothing better than I get home often quite late and I have that bottle of beer that's in the fridge. Mm. And that's enough for me.
Yeah.
And it's just knowing that at the end of the day, there is that bottle of beer while I do my diary or whatever.
Yeah.
And I think that
it's
in
like
that
a
sense,
ritual, isn't it?
But also, you need it because otherwise, if you go mad and think, right, I'm just going to watch every film or I'm going to just have ridiculous amounts of alcohol, you're going to burn yourself out and you also incapacitate yourself. So I think you need. It's like a race, I guess, isn't it?
Dare I say it, you can have too much of a good thing.
Yes.
It won't be as enjoyable or as special.
Yeah.
And that's something I think I've learned as I've got a bit older is, you know, I'm quite hedonistic by nature. I'm very, let's do it, yay! Yeah. You know, that's who I am and I've got some amazing experience. Yeah. But I think because of how I am more now, I'm more... moderation and enjoy it more.
But also it's like I have to go to work every day but I do the cinema of an evening, but it's the balance. I would never get them mixed up in the sense I wouldn't think, oh, do you know what? I'll just go to the cinema today. It's like, no, that would be a real taboo.
Yeah.
And the fact that I've got that innate sense that you know the boundaries,
you
know
what's
okay.
Grown up?
I think I've always had it, but
horror.
I didn't. But
shock
at Lambeter,
horror,
but at but at Lambeter, then again, it was quite normal for someone to say, "Let's go to the Quarry this afternoon and play pool." But I guess it was a bit different then because you didn't have this. You know, nobody. You'd go to as long as you were going to the lectures, nobody cared
when and how you
worked. So it's different. But now, but often nobody. I don't clock in when I go to work, but I wouldn't not go in.
Yeah,
if I had to clock in,
here.
I'd probably start hating my job because then I'd think, oh. I'm happy to choose to go in, but if somebody's making me go in, then suddenly you feel that you're looking at the clock all the time.
So that's all about psychology though, isn't it? I mean, with the job I do, we're very fortunate in that we are treated like adults. Mm. You know, yes, I have a line manager, a boss, and so does she, and blah, blah, blah. But nobody micromanages anyone. We are... It's assumed that you'll do your work and you're measured on your output, which again, I think going back to what you're saying about balance, I think a while ago... A lot of us who could probably resonate with this was there was almost a pressure that you've got to win the who could work the most hours each week competition to feel that you're the best, and that's so.
One of the worst experiences I remember. Right. One of my exams in the sports hall in my third year, and there was a mature student outside. She said, "Oh, I don't feel prepared." She said for this exam, she said, "I only did 14 hours revision yesterday," and of course everyone else is thinking, oh, I didn't do 14 hours, I'm going to fail.
I did about 14 minutes.
Yeah, exactly. So and that's the thing, you mustn't. One of the biggest lessons I've learnt in recent years is, you know, don't be fooled by other people's narratives.
Definitely.
Because that, you know, what and then mismatch from what they say and then what happens.
So
you just have to know yourself enough to know what works for you and to find that comfort zone.
Yes.
You know, other people may have different quirks to yourself, but it doesn't mean to say that their quirks are better than your quirks.
No, definitely. And I think within the workplace that can be true as well.
Well, a few more, if you're okay, a few more questions around whether your memories are predominantly positive. It sounds as though they really are.
I'm definitely a glass half full person. Mm. In fact, I would probably say, why is my glass only half full? Top it up. I am naturally an optimistic person. I'm realistic though as well. I'm not the kind of person that will only ever see the positive.
Yeah.
You know, I'm realistic too. And also you do have to look back sometimes and look at less positive things that have happened to you or your family or your friends within your life to then learn from them, and then that becomes a positive, a lessons learned. So nostalgia for me is predominantly positive, but also you do sometimes learn your greatest things through adversity and difficulty.
Because that's one of the other questions I was asking about whether you can be nostalgic about negative experiences. And I only ask that because sometimes it's easy to look back on past events and think, no, that was a horrible period. But it's what you learned from it. Suddenly you think, well, hang on, that was horrible, but
look how far
I survived.
Definitely. Yeah. You do have to look back to take the measure of where you were, where you've been, where you've come to now, what you've achieved. And just by doing that sort of internal analysis turns it into a positive situation. Yeah. And as long as you learn from those things and don't keep making the same mistakes, then there is a positivity to it.
And in terms of fulfilling the dreams you had when you were young, because would you ever have imagined, either when you were 5 or even at Lampeter, that you'd be doing what you're doing now?
No, actually, not at all. No, I think, to be fair, I don't think I knew what I wanted to do at those points. I think I was just sort of drifting along and waiting for that light bulb moment. So no, I wouldn't have thought. But I always wanted to be like a mermaid and swim underwater, and I've achieved that now. So that's something that I'm hugely grateful for, and that's a constant still.
So your younger self would say, good on you, Linda.
Yeah, I think so. In fact, my younger self would probably say, well, she might still have said go to Lampeter. But I think if I had my time again, or if I had the option to return to academia now as an adult, I would like to do a degree in marine biology.
Yeah, good for you.
Because I'm really genuinely very passionate about it. And I get involved you know, sort of environmental issues
as
well.
At the same time, though, it's not a bad thing sometimes that you did a degree in a different sort of area, but if you'd done marine biology at 18, maybe you would have hated it. And you would have gone to Lampeter, but you also wouldn't necessarily have had the same interest, because it might have killed, I mean, it probably wouldn't, but it might have killed off any
Could
of the been. Passion.
Yeah, so you, that's you, very
the whole point is that the interest in the sea is a space away from your job or your studies.
Very true. Yeah, that is true. Yeah. I hadn't thought of it that way. That's actually a really good way to think of it.
If I go to, you know, to the university that does DJ studies, I might hate it. You know? No, I want to do it. Don't
you
don't
ace it. Study.
Yeah.
You get first.
All right.
You get first.
My very last question is, are you a looking back or a looking forward kind of person?
Oh, I would say a little bit of both. Predominantly looking forward, because I like to be busy. I like to have things to look forward to, whether it be seeing family, friends, holidays, doing extra stuff, which is beyond my getting up, going to work and going to bed kind of mantra that we all seem to have in our lives. So definitely a looking forward kind of person. I also do like to look back, like we were just saying, to reflect. I think that's very important. I think also you can learn a lot by looking back, but also it teaches you to be grateful, I think, as well. And if I'm sort of lying in bed about to drift off to sleep at night, I often use that time to reflect and look back and feel very happy and grateful and contented. And or I might think, oh, that could have gone a bit better, but if that happens again, I'll know what to say. And so that's when I would reflect. But generally I'm very much what are we doing next week? Which holiday are we going on? Where are we going? You know, which film are we going to go and see? Which cinema? You know, what restaurant? So I'm very much a looking forward kind of person. And long may it continue.
Absolutely. Well, on that note, how amazing after 25 years to catch up with you,
Such
Linda.
Such a long time. It feels like no time at all. It's really been an absolute pleasure.
So good to see you. Thank you,
Linda. You too. Thank you.